Thomas Eakins is generally regarded as one of the greatest painters America has produced, but his life and character have remained something of a mystery until recently. In The Revenge of Thomas Eakins, Sidney Kirkpatrick introduces us to the real Eakins and tells us of the challenges he had to face. The book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Kirkpatrick to my show today. Hi.
Hey, you know, you just missed my bloodthirsty dwarves
who
accompanied me up to the studio.
Well, I hope you didn't regret that, although let's talk about Thomas Eakins. He died in 1916. How well was he known as an artist during his lifetime? Was he famous in America?
No. There were a lot of critics who were interested in his work, and he was very controversial. But you know, when he died in 1916, you couldn't give the paintings away. And in some respects, it was a blessing for us today because, a large collection of his work remained intact, remained together, despite those that were destroyed.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the destroyed later. Were the criticisms against him the same in the United States and in Europe?
I don't think he had much of a profile in Europe.
Although I mean, he studied
in Paris for a while. But yeah, he was a quintessential Philadelphian. And that was really one of the things that I appreciated so much about him was how much he loved America, how much he loved Philadelphia in particular. Do you remember, what was that movie? It was Rocky with Sylvester Stallone. That's really Thomas Eakins' neighborhood. And when you see Rocky running through the streets of Philadelphia, through the meatpacking district, and then up that great flight of stairs, that was really where Eakins lived and painted his whole life.
But Philadelphia is also where Mary Cassatt comes from.
Yeah.
It's where Barnes came from. They loved Impressionism. Philadelphia, in fact, probably was one of the first places where Americans collected Impressionists. So, and Eakins studied in Paris when the Impressionists were emerging as an important force. He obviously had certain avant-garde leanings. So how did he wind up painting the way he did?
Well, he went the other direction, and he was interested in realism right from the get-go. I mean, right from the start, his father taught penmanship at a Quaker school in Philadelphia. And from a very early age, he learned to break things down into little blocks and was just very, very interested in realism.
And he was also interested in photography, but his work is not photographic. He still comes out of a realistic tradition. I would think, if anything, he might have been inspired by the 17th century artists who used chiaroscuro and people like Courbet.
Sure.
He might have seen some links to someone like Degas.
The Spanish realists, are what he absolutely loved. Yeah, and he brought that home with him. I mean, even though he was studying in Paris, his trip to Spain was what made all the difference for him.
Do you think that he saw himself as avant-garde in a different way? Those paintings of medical procedures, putting the pubic hair on the nudes at a time when that still wasn't done, at least not in this country.
I don't know.
Because he was daring.
Well, I'm not sure he would have seen himself as daring. I think he saw himself as following that Spanish tradition. And just because all of the other artists were going the opposite direction, I don't think it really concerned him all that much. And I think it's that realism that fascinate people when they see his paintings today. For me, it's like... It's like seeing a trailer for a motion picture. You see one of Eakins' portraits, and it hits you just as if you're seeing a motion picture. It captures that kind of moment in time and really pulls you into it.
Because he was interested in photography.
Yeah.
Is that one of the complaints that people had at the time, that he was just too realistic?
Well, certainly photography and the arts, it was a big problem for painters at the time. And, painters were running the opposite direction. They would not acknowledge, the use of photography, in creating portraits, though it was commonly done. But, Eakins was very, very interested in science. And from an early age, he studied surgery. He went to medical school for 2 years.
He dissected cadavers.
Yeah.
He painted people dissecting cadavers.
Well, I mean, that was really his first love, was science. And I think he brought that to painting. And the result are almost scientific. It's wonderful stuff.
Why do you think he focused so much on portraiture? Was it just a way to make a living?
No, not at all. I think he came to love the human body. It's interesting in my own life. I mean, what interested me, I think, first in Aikens were really two things. I have a stepdaughter who's an artist in L.A., and she underwent open heart surgery. And it was really fascinating to me how that experience of open heart surgery changed her art, changed her perception of the human body. And she wanted to draw pictures, study her own heart. And of course, that's the same thing that Aikens went through, except maybe in the opposite direction, because he was, a young medical student doing surgery, and he came to appreciate the human body. And it brought around these wonderful masterpieces we have today.
But you say that 8 of the portraits that Aikens painted were burned by the people he'd painted. Did they just think he hadn't caught them well?
Well, I think it's fair to say that more portraits by Aikens were destroyed than any other great artist. And, it's primarily because of the realism that he brought to it. I mean, he truly loved the wrinkles, around a woman's eyes. He loved a mole on a face. He saw these things as beauty. There's a wonderful critic attacked him in his first big portrait, which is right here at the Metropolitan, of a rower out on the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, where Aikens himself rode. And they, in describing the painting, they described the wondrously ugly muscles. and these were things that just absolutely fascinated and Aikens loved.
And we are lucky here. We have some very fine Aikens
in
town.
You have a wonderful
collection.
The
Brooklyn Museum has terrific ones as well. So when did those works start being collected, if he was in so little repute when he died in 1916?
Well, when he died, there were approximately 300 or so paintings in circulation. And of those 300, probably 240 or so were in his house, in his townhouse in Philadelphia. And his widow held on to those and eventually was able to place some at the Metropolitan, and which is a really wonderful collection, and then eventually in the Philadelphia Museum.
But that means that people started reevaluating what
exactly
they thought of him. When did that happen?
Oh, throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s, became big in the 60s. But it really wasn't until the last decade that people really knew much about him.
And that's because some documents turned up.
Well, I mean, this is what is just so much fun about, the Aikens story. And I think this book is a guy named Charlie Bregler, who was a very poor art student, meaning he wasn't very successful, but he was a very devoted art student. He was devoted to Thomas Aikens, just worshipped him. And I think it bothered Bregler to see, his master being denigrated in the press. And after Aikens died, he became the secretary to Aikens' widow. But he was just very much devoted to, almost, one might even argue, psychopathically devoted. And after the widow died and all of the papers were in the house, this was a house that was continuously occupied for almost 60 years. The night before the house was to change hands and all the papers and things were to be burned, he broke into the house, started collecting it, just put them all in trunks, hat boxes, whatever he could find, and he hauled them back to his house. And it really wasn't for another 40 or 50 years that, art historians, anybody realized that they existed.
My guest is Sidney D. Kirkpatrick, who is both the writer and a documentary film producer. His most recent book before this one was Edgar Casey, An American Prophet, nothing like Thomas Aikens, who is the subject of the current one, The Revenge of Thomas Aikens, which is published by the Yale University Press. So what did those documents reveal about him that we didn't know before, that we should have known before?
Well, you got into insights into the real scandals that roiled his career. Previous to the discovery of these papers, the scandals had been rumored. It had been quietly discussed. No one really knew the hard, fast details.
Well, he'd been forced to leave Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, where he'd been a teacher. There were rumors because he loved painting the naked male body. At least some of his contemporaries wondered whether he might be a homosexual.
Oh, well, the academic community has certainly lobbed all kinds of grenades at Aikens over the last two decades. Everything from bestiality, incest, homosexuality. I mean, it runs the whole gamut. And I think these papers provide a really interesting, very dramatic insight, into
Well, did he talk about whether he might have done something incestuous?
No.
So he could still have done all these awful things. He was not the most pleasant person that ever lived.
No, and it's a shame in many respects that he didn't have a sense of the politics the way that Walt Whitman did. Walt Whitman, various things were alleged about him over the years, but Whitman had a finesse about him and was able to work through these things. Aikens was very much a curmudgeon. At the end, he and his wife hold themselves up in their, Mount Vernon Street studio and didn't go out, didn't discuss these issues, didn't address them publicly. And it's a shame that he didn't fight it.
Well, what would have happened if he had? Do you think that he would have cleared his name?
Probably not, but it would certainly have been a lot more interesting to read about it.
It is interesting you mentioned Whitman because he painted Whitman. And
they were good friends.
And he's been compared by some to Herman Melville because he was less appreciated in his lifetime. And Melville, of course, Moby Dick becomes the great American novel, if there is such a thing, long after he's dead.
Well, certainly Aikens has been rediscovered in a very serious way and can stand alongside Whitman and Melville in our generation in a way that 30 years ago he wouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, every American today needs to know something about Aikens.
But when did he become one of the great American painters? When did that change?
Certainly within the last two or three decades.
Really? Because I remember thinking of him as a great artist when I was a kid. He was already, it was Aikens had his little book and Thomas and Ryder had his little book and, Jackson Pollock had his little book. There was a whole series of popular books that I bought when I was a kid.
Well, you studied under Rothko.
But it means that they considered him important enough to have given him one of those little books.
Yeah, Well, there hasn't really been a definitive biography until now, primarily because of the papers, this is my first book with the University Press, with the Yale University Press, and I'm just very tickled and impressed, surprised at what a great publishing job they did. I mean,
it's beautiful with lots of wonderful pictures.
Yeah, and maps. There's a great map of Philadelphia. One of the things that fascinated me so much was that virtually all the important things that took, events in Aikens's life all took place within about a, 10-15 block radius.
So what was the revenge that you refer to in the title?
Well, the New York Times really took me to task this Sunday about the title, but I stand by it 100% because, I just love it. I love the concept that a city which essentially turned its back on Thomas Aikens should today, have a traffic circle named in his honor. In my sort of daydreams, I can imagine Aikens as a ghost, haunting out in front of the Philadelphia Museum on Aikens Oval, flagging down, cars, stopping cars, and say, you know, see, I told you so.
And what about the heirs of the people who destroyed the paintings? They probably are kicking themselves as well, or kicking the memories of the people who burned them.
Well, one can certainly understand the families, you know, that got a hold of these paintings, and they didn't want to, you know, remember their aunt or their uncle, their mother. One of the fun stories is of a mother superior at a nunnery that Ed Akins had done a portrait of, and the mother herself absolutely loved this portrait. But the nuns around her just couldn't stand it. I mean, they just literally couldn't stand it. And as soon as she died, they packed it away, put it away, and eventually destroyed it. And that was one example of many, many, you know, paintings that were destroyed.
Was he a great photographer?
I think he was an excellent photographer. He was also stood on the cusp of breaking into motion pictures. You know, he built his own motion picture camera. He showed people
moving in sequence.
Exactly.
The Revenge of Thomas Akins is published by Yale University Press. My great thanks to Sidney D. Kirkpatrick for being my guest today.